From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Will President Bush appoint another version of Michael Powell to run the Federal Communications Commission, someone who believes that media companies should grow larger and the public interest is meaningless?
Michael Powell steps down as chair of the Federal Communications Commission. We'll take a look at his 4 years on the commission and his push for media consolidation. And we'll speak with two activists who interrupted President Bush's inaugural address.
We pulled out our banners and we get up on the chairs and we stand there with our banners. And immediately, security starts running over, grabbing our banners. The Bushites start grabbing our banners. And we're saying, didn't you listen to the president? He just said the people of the world need the freedom of dissent. And that's what we're doing. It's okay. It's on message.
And longtime WBAI commentator John Hess died this weekend at the age of 87. He wrote for the New York Times for almost a quarter of a century.
You might find it hard to believe that our nation got along without a CIA from the time it was born to beyond World War II.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Baghdad, a large explosion has gone off near the political headquarters of interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, injuring at least 10 people. The attack comes less than 1 week before the January 30th national election. On Sunday, the U.S. ambassador in Iraq, John Negroponte, acknowledged for the first time there would be problems in the election. He appeared on Fox News Sunday.
There'll be some problematic areas, particularly in the center, in the Sunni triangle, especially the provinces of Al-Anbar and Nineveh. But even there, great efforts are being made to enable every Iraqi eligible to do so to be able to vote.
Meanwhile, Jordanian militant Abu Musab al-Zarqawi threatened again Sunday to disrupt the elections. In a new broadcast, he described candidates as demi-idols and voters as infidels. In other Iraq news, the Shiite cleric who is expected to become the Iraqi prime minister after the January 30th election has said he will call for the withdrawal of U.S. troops, quote, as soon as possible. According to an article in the Times of London, Abdulaziz al-Hakim said, quote, no people in the world accepts occupation and nor do we accept the continuation of American troops in Iraq. The leader of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq also suggested Iraq may reach out to Syria and Iran for help with future security issues. Interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi responded by telling the BBC it's too early to discuss the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. Two U.S. soldiers were convicted on Saturday of charges related to the killing of an Iraqi woman who was working for the military as an interpreter. One of the soldiers shot the 28-year-old mother in the head. The soldiers originally lied to investigators and said the woman had shot herself. Later, they admitted what happened but claimed it was an accident. Specialist Charles Hooser was sentenced to 3 years in jail. Specialist Rami Dajani received 18 months in jail. Both received a reduction in rank and a bad conduct discharge. The Washington Post reports U.S. authorities paid the victim's family $25,000 in compensation for her death. The New York Times is reporting that during the inauguration, the Pentagon stationed in Washington a small group of super-secret commando forces similar to the Special Operations Forces hunting for Osama bin Laden. Under a top-secret military plan, codenamed Power Geyser, the commando units have been trained to conduct counterterrorism missions in support of civilian agencies inside the United States. The special missions units belong to the Joint Special Operations Command, a secretive command based at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, home of the Army unit Delta Force. The codename Power Geyser was first made public in a new book entitled Codenames, Deciphering U.S. Military Plans, Programs, and Operation in the 9/11 World. The book, written by William Arkin, lists some 3,000 codenames for secret governmental operations. The Toronto Star is reporting the U.S. government is attempting to dismiss a lawsuit brought by Canadian citizen Maher Arar, claiming the litigation would jeopardize national security. 2 years ago, the Syrian-born software engineer was detained by U.S. officials while on a stopover in New York at Kennedy Airport. He was then jailed and secretly deported to Syria. He was held for almost a year in an underground cell not much larger than a grave where he was reportedly tortured. Time magazine in Canada recently named him the country's newsmaker of the year. Now the U.S. government's attempting to have a lawsuit filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights dismissed, invoking the rarely use state secrets privilege, the Justice Department claims that any release of information on Arar would jeopardize, quote, intelligence, foreign policy, and national security interests of the United States. Arar's attorney, Maria LaHood, said, quote, they're asking the court to sanction their cover-up, basically. And Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has canceled a planned trip to Germany for an upcoming security conference because he's been accused in a German court of committing war crimes. The Center for Constitutional Rights has also filed a complaint, they did it last month, accusing Rumsfeld of war crimes and torture in connection with the mistreatment of Iraqi detainees at Abu Ghraib. German laws allow the trial of war crimes regardless of where they are carried out. The center said it had turned to German prosecutors as a court of last resort because the U.S. government, quote, is unwilling to open an independent investigation and had, quote, refused to join the International Criminal Court. Michael Powell has announced he's stepping down from his post as head of the Federal Communications Commission. He was a leading advocate for deregulation and the relaxation of media ownership rules. We'll have more on that story later in the program. In news on Social Security, two prominent Republican lawmakers questioned President Bush's push to privatize Social Security accounts. House Ways and Means Committee Chair Bill Thomas appeared on Meet the Press Sunday and questioned Bush's description of the state of Social Security as a crisis. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine says she opposes the high cost of making the switch to private accounts. The short-run cost to the government is estimated to be $1 to $2 trillion. Snowe said, quote, there's a lot of fear among seniors. At the United Nations, the General Assembly is conducting a special session today to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi concentration camp at Auschwitz. On Sunday, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan said, quote, the evil that destroyed 6 million Jews and others in those camps is one of that still threatens all of us today. The global community must ensure that such horror never occurs again, he said. The National Organization for Women has called for the resignation of Harvard University President Lawrence Summers after he suggested men are biologically suited to excel at math and science more than women. In environmental news, a new study has found that 44 nations are now more environmentally sustainable than the United States. The U.S. ranked below almost most of Western Europe and half the nations in the Americas. Finland, Norway, and Uruguay were ranked highest. Other nations ranking in the top 10 most environmentally sustainable were Sweden, Iceland, Canada, Switzerland, Guyana, Argentina, and Austria. North Korea was ranked the lowest. In Venezuela, tens of thousands of supporters of President Hugo Chavez rallied in Caracas on Sunday. Chavez criticized the U.S. and Colombian governments for meddling in Venezuelan affairs. Colombia recently admitted it paid a bounty to kidnap a top-ranking member of the Colombian rebel group FARC while he was in Caracas. Chavez said, quote, Venezuela must be respected. Nobody can deny that what Colombia has done is a violation of international law, but the only government that's defended this vulgar error is the imperialist government of the United States, he said. Last week, Condoleezza Rice described Chavez's rule as very deeply troubling. At the rally, some held signs with messages to President Bush reading, quote, "Venezuela is not Iraq." The king of late-night TV, Johnny Carson, has died at the age of 79. For three decades, he hosted The Tonight Show and became one of the country's most popular entertainers. Meanwhile, longtime journalist and radio commentator John Hess has also died at the age of 87. For 24 years, he worked at the New York Times covering the Paris peace talks. He later became a regular on Pacifica Station WBAI, providing daily commentaries for the WBAI evening news. He continued writing and recording those commentaries up until his death. Last year, Seven Stories published his autobiography entitled My Times, a Memoir of Dissent. In it, he criticized his former employer. He wrote, quote, about the New York Times, "Muckraking tended to make the Times brass nervous. Truly investigating, questioning, skeptical reporting was practically un-Timesian." Last year, John Hess started his weblog entitled John L. Hess Dissents on the website Counterpunch. Alexander Coburn wrote, quote, "John Hess grew old the way journalists are meant to, but almost never do. He never stopped stamping on the toes of the powers that be, never lost his edge, never got out of his harness." And another member of the Pacifica family has died. Folk singer and activist Jolie Rickman passed away last week after a battle with cancer. She's the former music coordinator at Democracy Now! This is her song, Romero, based on the lyrics of a homily given by Salvadoran Archbishop Oscar Romero on the day he was assassinated, March 24th, 1980.
This is my appeal to you, living confined, who service guards, police, and garrison. My brothers, you are all from among the same people, but at your hands your people die in the name of God. Listen to the cries of the suffering. Rise up to the heavens. Why, I beseech you, order you, beg you. Auto a la repression. Above all commands, you're given by a man. The law of God must stand, and thou shalt not kill.
Romero by Jolie Rickman, who died this weekend. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A large explosion has rocked the center of Baghdad, injuring at least 10 people today. The suicide car bomb, which comes just 6 days before the scheduled January 30th elections, went off at a checkpoint near the offices of the U.S.-backed Iraqi interim prime minister, Iyad Alawi. Supporters of the militant leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi have claimed responsibility for the attack. On Sunday, Zarqawi apparently declared war on the election. In an audio tape on the internet, allegedly by Zarqawi, he called the Sunni Muslims to fight against the vote. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, John Negroponte, acknowledged serious problems ahead of the weekend's elections. In appearances on Sunday talk shows, he set a low bar for judging the success of the vote and dismissed suggestions that victorious Iraqi candidates might force an early withdrawal of U.S. troops. As violence continues to rage across Iraq, the U.S.-backed interim government has announced sweeping security measures to protect voters. The Iraqi government will declare a national holiday from January 29th to 31st, at which point an 8 p.m. curfew will be imposed. Few cars will be allowed in the streets. Citizens will not be permitted to carry weapons. And the Baghdad airport will be closed. Iraqi troops will be in charge of securing polling sites, while U.S. forces will remain in the background to prevent the image of American soldiers watching over Iraqis while they vote. The BBC reports the whereabouts of polling polling stations will only be made public at the very last minute, and the massive logistical operation of getting ballot boxes and papers in place will be carried out in secrecy. We go now to Baghdad to Patrick Coburn, a journalist with the London Independent. Welcome to Democracy Now, Patrick.
Thank you.
Can you talk about the situation now in Iraq in these few days before the election?
Well, I think there is a mood of growing terror in Baghdad. I mean, because of the expectation that there are going to be lots of car bombs during the election. I was this morning, as you mentioned, there was a suicide bomb attack on the offices of Yedalawi, the prime minister, and I went to the Yarmouk hospital just afterwards, where some of the security men who'd been injured had just been taken. And I was very struck by the fact that even in the hospital, the wounded men refused to take off their black ski masks. They're terrified that anybody would identify them and maybe shoot them or kidnap them later. They were very frightened of anybody taking their photograph. Looking around Baghdad this morning, the traffic is much less than I'd expect. Usually there are big traffic jams here. A lot of people, I think, are just staying at home. Having said that, there isn't much more violence than is normal, but there is an expectation that there's going to be a lot more bombs, and people are very frightened.
And what do you think will be the turnout?
In Baghdad, I'd be surprised if the turnout was very high. In strong Sunni areas, Sunni Muslim areas like Adamiya, people will boycott the polls, they'll want to abstain, and if they don't, they'll also know it's pretty dangerous to vote. In Shia areas, people will probably want to vote and will vote. But again, there's some trepidation that from suicide bombers. So within Baghdad, I'd have thought, given the dangers, that and that even if it wasn't dangerous, many of the Sunni want to boycott the polls, but I would have thought the turnout will not be that great.
And can you talk about Abdulaziz al-Hakim, according to the Times of London, said no people in the world accepts occupation, nor do we accept the continuation of American troops in Iraq. The Shiite cleric expected to become the Iraqi prime minister.
Well, the Sunday Times in London may expect him to be the next prime minister. I must say I don't. I think it's unlikely that a religious figure like him would be the next prime minister. But it's true that, you know, Iraqis don't want to be occupied, and nobody wants to be occupied. But one of the problems of the exile parties that came back after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein is that they are very dependent on the U.S., both those who like Yedalawi, the prime minister, and even those who say they're opposed to the occupation. They don't have armed forces themselves. So there's an element of hypocrisy in this. I think that all the exile groups standing in the election have, whatever they say, at the end of the day, are very dependent on the U.S. Army. And this, of course, will discredit them in the eyes of certainly many Sunni Muslims in Iraq.
The Knight Ridder News Service, Tom Lasseter and Jonathan Landay, have just come out with a piece talking about the Iraqi insurgency growing larger, more effective, saying the unfavorable trends of the war are clear. U.S. military fatalities from hostile acts have risen from an average of 17 per month just after Bush declared an end to major combat operations to an average of 82 per month. The average number of U.S. soldiers wounded by hostile acts per month has spiraled from 142 to 800. 108 in the same period. Iraqi civilians have suffered even more deaths and injuries, although reliable statistics aren't available. Attacks on the U.S.-led coalition since November 2003 have risen from 735 to 2,400 in October. The average number of mass casualty bombings has grown from zero in the first 4 months of the U.S. occupation to an average of 13 per month. Electricity production has been below pre-war levels since October. Iraq is pumping about 500,000 barrels a day, fewer than its pre-war peak of 2.5 million barrels per day as a result of attacks, according to the State Department. Patrick Coburn, finally, can you comment on these trends?
Yes, I mean, all this is true. It has been getting worse. The military situation has been getting worse. At the time of the attack on Fallujah, the recapture of Fallujah, you'll recall that Mosul in northern Iraq, is a much larger city, largely fell under the control of the insurgents. Now, every so often here, we have announcements that a turning point has been reached. The turning point was first of all meant to be the capture of Saddam Hussein over a year ago, and there were lots of optimistic things being said by U.S. Military and civilian leaders. Things progressively got worse. The handover of sovereignty in the middle of last year was meant to be another turning point. And now we've reached the election is said to be a third turning point, but I don't think, talking to Iraqis, they really don't believe that.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Patrick Coburn, for joining us. Patrick Coburn writes for the London Independent. He's speaking to us from Baghdad on this few days before the January 30th election is set to take place. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll hear from several people who interrupted President Bush's inaugural address in Washington because of the war in Iraq. Stay with us.
Brothers, I assure you, you are not obliged to obey one who tells you to kill your people. Now reclaim your conscience, now reclaim your people. Even you, a soldier, can in the name of God listen to the cries of the suffering. Rise up to the heavens. Why, I beseech you, order you, beg you, in the name of God, listen to the cries of the suffering. Rise up to the heavens. Why, I beseech you, order you, beg you.
Just Jolie Rickman here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The folk singer died over the weekend of cancer. She was singing Romero. We turn now to the second inauguration of George W. Bush and the protests. On Thursdays, Bush was met by thousands of protesters who took to the streets in Washington, D.C. amid unprecedented levels of security to oppose the policies of the Bush administration. But you wouldn't have known it by watching the corporate media. The major cable news network showed footage of the presidential inauguration in the Capitol, the motorcade through Pennsylvania Avenue, and President Bush and the First Lady getting out of their heavily armored Cadillac to walk the last block to the White House. In the evening, news anchors reported from glamorous events as they followed the president and his wife to 9 inaugural balls. But this past weekend, the organization Media Matters issued a report criticizing the major cable news networks for ridiculing the protesters at the inauguration and downplaying their numbers. Estimated over 10,000 protesters took to the streets of Washington. At one point, Fox News reported only a few dozen people showed up at a large rally organized by Answer officer. On the next day, the New York Times reported thousands of protesters had shown up in the area where Ansar received a protest permit. CNN host Wolf Blitzer described the protesters as, quote, angry, angry people. He also explicitly tried to downplay the protesters' significance. On the air, he said, quote, we don't want to make too much of the protesters because we don't know how many there were. Certainly the nature of this business, the nature of television, we could over-exaggerate based on the images, and they might just be a tiny, tiny overall number. And Fox News host Brit Hume said the fact that protests were occurring, quote, isn't very important. In addition, Media Matters also tracked the degree that Republican and conservative guests and commentators outnumbered Democrats and progressives on Fox, ratio 17 to 6. It was 13 to 2 on MSNBC and 10 to 1 on CNN. On Democracy Now!, we continue our coverage of Inauguration 2005 by bringing you the voices of dissent not aired in the corporate media. This weekend, I caught up with two of those who interrupted President Bush's inaugural address, among them Jeremiah Jenkins of Harvard Divinity School.
My name is Jeremiah Jenkins. I'm the editor of No Empire, a Journal of Conscience at Harvard Divinity School. I received a ticket the morning of the inauguration to the Blue Zone, which is as close as you could get to the president. I got in about the time that Cheney was reciting his oath. I sat down and I heard the rumbles behind me of Code Pink and some other demonstrators that were unfurling signs and chanting. And towards the end of his speech, I began booing him loudly, loud enough that he heard me and was startled for a moment. And then I began chanting, "Hey Bush, where are the poor? Did you ship them all off to war?" And then I continued to chant that as I was dragged out of the inaugural zone.
Were you near the press?
I was actually right next to the press. So there were so initially the first people that surrounded me were the press, and then I was kind of overwhelmed with the police. But it was near the press tent. It was about 30 rows back from the president. He could see and hear me. So
how do you know that?
Well, I had the suspicion that he heard me just because of the tone of his speech and everything, and sort of there was a pause there. But the Boston Globe actually reported that all of the dignitaries and Bush could hear me and that he was momentarily startled. So
why'd you do it?
Well, actually, I guess I could say that I was really encouraged by his rhetoric that young people should find a cause greater than themselves to live for, and I, you know, I thought that was my cue. So if he's going to use the rhetoric of liberty and freedom and democracy, then I'm going to show him what it really means.
Jeremiah Jenkins, I asked Jeremiah Jenkins how he chose the chant, "Hey Bush, where are the poor? Did you ship them all off to war?"
Yeah, I grew up poor, and I have a deep compassion for poor people, and I feel that this administration has neglected poor and working people. And so as I was there, I was surrounded by wealthy people. There were fur coats everywhere, and I knew that poor people needed to be offered more than just military service. So I feel that by taking all these resources and diverting all of these resources into a bogus war instead of investing it into poor people, working people, I think that it's just a sham. And so I felt that by chanting this, I would be communicating to him that he has abandoned poor and working people.
I'm Medea Benjamin with Code Pink, and from various sources, we got 8 VIP tickets into the inauguration, and we spent the whole night until about 4 in the morning before making banners, and we literally, each one of us had 1 or 2, some of us 3 banners on us that we wrapped around our bodies. We figured most of them would get caught, but maybe one would get through. So we went to through the security, and it's a pretty serious security. You got to like show everything, empty out your pockets, open your jacket. They pad you down. They feel you all over the place. Every single one of us got through with every single banner that we had. We went in, and we had tickets that were at the very end section, which first we sat down on the end section. Then we realized nobody's really watching, and we could just start making our way up a little further. So first we'd send 2 people, and then they'd go sit up there, and they'd pass us back some tickets in case we needed them, and then we would get the other 2 up there. And finally, all 8 of us were sitting in a higher section. And we thought, wow, you know, that's pretty easy. Then George Bush started speaking, and we were waiting for a good moment, and we found a perfect moment. Good thing we didn't wait for him to say Iraq, because he never said that the whole time. But he did say the freedom of dissent and how important that is for people around the world to have that freedom. We thought, okay, that's our time. So we pulled out our banners, and we get up on the chairs, and we stand there with our banners. And immediately, security starts running over, grabbing our banners. The Bushites start grabbing our banners. And we're saying, didn't you listen to the president? He just said the people of the world need the freedom of dissent. And that's what we're doing. It's okay. It's on message. And they're looking around. They don't know what to do. And the cops literally say, okay. And then they leave. And they said, but you better be quiet this time. And so they're gone. And then we're sitting there for a couple more minutes. And then we thought, well, he's saying some more things that we really don't agree with. Maybe we should get up again. So we get up again, and we had some extra banners. So we took out the other set of banners and got up there. And this time the police came, and the Bushites were really mad, and they were struggling with us and grabbing our things.
What did the banners say, and what were you chanting?
The banners said everything from no war and the occupation. Champagne is flying, soldiers are dying. One banner said, stop the celebration, end the occupation. And this time we started chanting, end the occupation, stop the celebration, bring the troops home now. And so the police came over, and they dragged six of the women out. And then two of us were literally like arms and legs wrapped around each other and around the chairs and wouldn't let go and wouldn't let go. And they're tugging at us from one end to the other, and they're pulling at all different angles, and we're just holding on for dear life. And finally, they all look at each other, and they just give up, and they say, these women, they are too much. And then they say to each other, can you believe it? They spend billions of dollars on national security. They're looking for all these weapons of mass destruction, and they can't stop these protesters from getting in with their banners. That's pathetic. So we're all laughing, and then we said, would you like us to get up? And they said, sure. So we walked out with them. They arrested us. We were charged with loud and boisterous disorderly conduct. We spent the night in jail. We got let out at 3 in the morning. And the most amazing thing about all of this is for the crime of interrupting the president, we got a $25 fine. I recommend it to anyone. The best $25 I've ever spent.
Thanks. What was your response to being charged with that on Inauguration Day? Not the fine, but the charge, disorderly conduct.
Well, I felt that they probably got it backwards, that they really meant that George Bush was the guilty one of disorderly conduct, that Dick Cheney was certainly guilty of disorderly conduct, and Condoleezza Rice is guilty of disorderly conduct. We could go down the chain. So we laughed with the police officers back in the jail, too, because they all agreed with us. You know, D.C., they don't like Bush very much here. And we had a good laugh talking about how they really should reverse the charges.
Medea Benjamin of Code Pink and Jeremiah Jenkins of Harvard Divinity School separately engaged in actions during the inaugural address and were taken out. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we turn now to news that Michael Powell stepping down as chair of the Federal Communications Commission, ending a contentious four-year term. His resignation announced in a Wall Street Journal editorial on Friday, Powell wrote, quote, having completed a bold and aggressive agenda, it's time for me to pursue other opportunities and let someone else take the reins of the agency. The seeds of our policies are taking firm root in the marketplace and are starting to blossom, he said. Powell, who's the son of the outgoing Secretary of State, General Colin Powell, was appointed to the commission in 97 by President Bill Clinton and promoted to chair by President Bush in 2001. In June 2003, Michael Powell and two other Republicans on the FCC pushed through new media ownership rules that would have allowed the television networks to own a few more stations, tighten national radio ownership rules, and let one company own the biggest newspaper and television station in almost every city. During the run-up to the FCC vote, more than 2 million letters, emails, and faxes were sent to the FCC, almost all of them opposed to weakening the nation's media ownership regulations. The rules were later overturned by a court that said the commission had failed to justify the ruling. The replacements being considered for Michael Powell are said by administration officials to include another Republican member of the commission, Kevin Martin, Becky Klein, a former head of the Public Utility Commission in Texas, Patrick Wood, the head of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and Michael Gallagher, head of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. We're joined now by two people, Jeffrey Chester, Executive Director, Center for Digital Democracy and Petri Dish, organizer of the Prometheus Radio Project, which is a Philadelphia not-for-profit dedicated to the democratization of the airwaves through the proliferation of non-commercial community-based micro-power radio stations. Jeff Chester, let's begin with you. Your response to Michael Powell's resignation and his tenure.
Well, I think the most important thing is who will replace Michael Powell. And now there's potentially two other seats at the FCC. Potentially three seats are open. And I think the tenure of Michael Powell has served a lesson for the public that the chair of the FCC is an extremely important position. Up until Michael Powell, we've really sort of taken the FCC chair for granted. It hasn't gotten that much attention. But I think it's clear that the chair can act in very destructive ways towards our media system, to journalism, to creative expression. We have to place as much concern about who runs the FCC as we do our federal judicial nomination. So I'm hoping that there's going to be a campaign and we can ramp up and influence who gets the job and, more importantly, who doesn't get the job.
Petri Dish, if you could respond. It was Prometheus Radio Project, a true David and Goliath story, that brought the suit in Philadelphia that led to the rules being overturned by the court there.
Well, sure. Early on in his term, Michael Powell had said to an audience of communications lawyers that his goal during his administration was to make it so that when major media companies wanted to merge, you know, Tribune Company wanted to buy Time Warner or whatever, that he was going to try to get this processed in something like 14 business days. And, you know, we had all just applied for low-power radio stations. You know, these are 100-watt radio stations, the power of a light bulb. And our applications had dragged on for 3 years, 4 years, and had just sort of languished at the commission. And we saw that there was a serious sort of skewing of priorities by Powell's administration. And we just felt that the FCC was bending over backwards for the corporations, but not taking the concerns of regular people seriously. And so when they tried to steamroll through their agenda on allowing all these corporations to merge, we felt it was very appropriate for us to take them to court and do our best to get the FCC to listen to the concerns of ordinary Americans.
And what do you think will happen from here?
Well, it's very hard to say. I mean, the FCC is going to be led by Republicans. There's always a 3-2 skew in favor of the party of the president. We have two excellent Democratic commissioners at this point, and it's hard to say who is going to get nominated to head the FCC. I'd have to say that, you know, with a Republican courts, with Republican Senate, Republican presidency, and Republican Congress, you know, we can look forward to more of the same sorts of policies on media ownership. It's hard to say how they're going to be pursued, but we have no doubt what the agenda of the Bush administration will be.
Jeff Chester, in the announcement of the news that Michael Powell was resigning on the networks, they often talked about the lead was that he was really conducting the battle against obscenity, referring to the whole case of Janet Jackson. Can you talk about that and the significance of that versus the launching the media consolidation, perhaps the greatest in history?
Well, I actually think Michael Powell did not like having to be America's nanny-in-chief, and one reason why he's resigning so soon is because he was forced by the Bush administration and the Republican leadership in Congress to seize this issue of so-called indecency, which
the Republicans have polled and realize it resonates with a lot of their core supporters. I mean, here was a guy, Powell, who really believed that the marketplace, so to speak, should determine what people see. He didn't believe in any kind of regulatory context for the most part. So this was forced upon him by the Republicans. And it's clearly had a chilling effect, and one of our concerns should be that whoever runs the FCC, and it could be a current commissioner, Kevin Martin, who is a big crusade against indecency person, he could be the next chair, and he would not have to go through a confirmation because he's already sitting. But whoever is the chair of the FCC will have tremendous influence on what happens to the internet and all digital media. That's one reason why the stakes are so high and why we have to be more organized and vigilant this time. Will it continue to be an open network, or will the internet, as supported by Powell, come increasingly under the control of the biggest cable and telephone companies?
I wanted to ask you about other media news. The Wall Street Journal is reporting today that federal antitrust enforcers are investigating plans by the newspaper companies Gannett and the New York Times to acquire or invest in local rivals. The Justice Department's investigating Gannett's proposed buyout of the Midwest community newspaper Hometown Communications Network, Inc. Meanwhile, the Justice Department has opened a preliminary inquiry into the New York Times plans to take a 49% stake in Metro Boston, a free daily that competes with the Boston Globe, which is also owned by the New York Times.
Well, this is certainly a worthwhile investigation. I don't know whether it will actually lead to anything. The Boston Herald, in particular, which is the second paper in the Boston market and which has good conservative Republican contacts in Washington, that's one reason why they've taken on this case, no doubt. It's very concerned about the New York Times' growing market presence in the Boston area, and it's buying a minority control of this free weekly paper. What it illustrates is that the biggest media companies are simply buying up whatever's left standing, in the print and broadcast arenas. And the FCC has to redo the rules now as a result of the case brought by Prometheus and Media Access Project. So once again, whoever's chair will determine, who can own your newspaper, who can own your radio and television stations, whether or not there'll be any competition at all for programming on cable and satellite.
Well, Jeff Chester, Petri Dish, thanks very much for joining us. Jeff Chester of Center for Digital Democracy, Petri Dish of the Prometheus Radio Project. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, William Rivers Pitt. Stay with us.
Here we go. We got the call.
When we want peace, they drop a bomb on them. When they want war, they drop a bomb on them. They bring harm on them to gain power. They drop a bomb on them. All on them. Allies, they call on them. The media says to remain calm because they don't drop a bomb on them. Those who don't cooperate, they drop a bomb on them. Land, rich, and gold, caution. They read us peace first, then drop a bomb on them. What? In the newspapers, read it in their long column. In hope for that? Nah, I didn't vote for that. I vote for rap. Politicians can get choked for that and approach with a bat. For me, it'll be over, black. I'd be thrown in the back of a squad car. See, the system doesn't go for that. Loans and tax control the pack. They give less than what they owe us back, but you know that. These are old facts. They never gave the country a soul back. Drop bombs in Africa for gold stacks. I don't know what you was told, Jack. You watched them explode in Iran and Iraq when they couldn't control the flow of crack. And oil rates had a negative impact. You better think back. They dropped an atomic bomb to shake the map. Nagasaki, terrorist attack. Millions died and we can never bring them back. But many veterans deny the points presented in my rap. Federal mission intact. Economic mechanisms put in place are there to try to throw us off track. When we want peace, they drop a bomb on them. When they want war, they drop a bomb on them. They bring harm on them to gain power. They drop a bomb on them. All on them. Allies, they call on them. The media says to remain calm.
Insight, drop a bomb. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country, Pacifica stations and NPR stations, public access TV stations, as well as PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, Dish Networks, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV as well, Channel 375. We video and audio stream at democracynow.org, where you can also hear all of our counter-inaugural coverage last week. We turn now to some of the events that took place this weekend after the inauguration. Hundreds of people gathered at the University of the District of Columbia, Progressive Democrats of America, to hear various people speak through the day to strategize and organize over the next 4 years. Among those who spoke was William Rivers Pitt, editor of truthout.org.
We're here to talk about how progressive media, the alternative media, can get its message out to the people who really need to hear it. I have a couple of quick examples of why this needs to happen. I had a kind of an amusing moment during the inauguration. I was taking a break on a bench with a couple of people who were protesting, one of whom had a sign that read, "Bush lied, thousands died." Guy comes by and says, "Well, what did he lie about?" So, you sit there and you say, "You remember the 2003 State of the Union Address? What about it?" Well, in the State of the Union Address in 2003, Mr. Bush said that there were, 26,000 liters of anthrax, 38,000 liters of botulinum toxin, 500 tons, which is 1 million pounds, of sarin mustard and VX nerve agent, 30,000 munitions capable of delivering the stuff, mobile biological weapons labs and uranium from Niger for use in nuclear bombs. By the way, the page describing all of this is still up on the White House website today. It's called Disarm Saddam Hussein. You can go find it yourself. I said, "That's a pretty big lie." His response, "That was the Democrats lied about that." Miracles of nature, some of these people. The second moment happened as I was sitting around in my friend's house the day after the inauguration, watching in a moment of total masochism. I turned on CNN. To keep an eye on I'm apparently engaged in a foot race with a blizzard to try to get home, trying to figure out where this was, and they were doing a segment on the guys who prepare George W. Bush's food so he doesn't get poisoned. So I'm sitting there watching this, and they talk to some guy, didn't really give a title, no big deal. He's talking about the process by which they do this, and over his right shoulder, very visible in the camera shot, was a Heinz ketchup bottle that said "Kerry Flip Flop." No comment on it, no nothing. It was just out there. This was perfect propaganda. Perfect. The alternative media, all the people who are involved in this, need to engage the mainstream media on its own ground. And we have to do it in a number of different ways. First way, I think the alternative media would do well to help promote in any way, shape, or form internet connections and easy access to internet and easy access to machines in poor and rural communities.
Yeah.
One of the best things I saw out on the inauguration route, besides the tens of thousands of protesters, were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of alternative journalists out there with their cameras and their little PDA things, this thing right here, Instantaneous reporting on what's actually happening. We engage these people on their own ground and we make them irrelevant. It can happen. It is happening. I'll tell you something. The best example of that I saw was in the run-up to the January 6th challenge of the electors. On the morning of that challenge, every means of communication with Capitol Hill, email, fax, telephone, was locked because so many people were calling in to get somebody to stand up, and it worked. It was one of the most impressive displays of grassroots organizing that I'd seen in a long time, and it was the alternative media that pushed that. We do have the power to do this. When Stephanie Chubbs Jones stood up and said, "I do have a senator," That was proof positive to me that we have the power to do this. We will overwhelm them with data, with thousands of our own people out there actually reporting on what is happening, immediately delivering it to the internet. Meanwhile, push as hard as we can to move internet access into the communities that desperately need it, desperately need this information. It's going to be a bit of a fight, especially considering the Congress that we have, but I don't see a good rhetorical argument against it. I don't imagine how anybody could stand up in the House of Representatives and stand against it. So if you are interested in seeing this happen, if you are interested in taking down this farce of a mainstream media, that's how we get started. Thanks.
William Rivers Pitt of truthout.org speaking to Progressive Democrats of America at the University of the District of Columbia, UDC. The night before, at Reverend Graylin Hagler's Plymouth Congregational Church in Washington, D.C., hundreds of people gathered on the day after the inauguration. Among those who addressed the crowd was Damu Smith of Black Voices for Peace.
Yesterday, I watched the president in his inauguration speech, mentioned freedom 20-plus times. The day before, I heard his stone-faced, reactionary nominee for Secretary of State, Ms. Condoleezza, speak so incessantly about the issue of torture. George Bush doesn't know anything about freedom because he's not hearing the cries of the Haitian people. He's not hearing the cries of the Palestinian people who live under the boot of Israel's brutal and barbaric and racist occupation of the Palestinian people. He does not hear the cries of the Iraqi people. He does not hear the cries of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib. He does not hear the cries of the people in the Congo. Well, the United States policy over so many years created the division in that country that we're seeing right now. I didn't hear him talk about the people in the far region of the Sudan. I didn't hear him talk about the people in the ghettos and barrios of America. I didn't hear him talk about the working people of our country who don't have a living wage and don't have health care. I didn't hear him talk about our youth who are dying in our streets and our children who are going hungry every day. I didn't hear him talk about any of these things. He knows nothing about freedom. We know everything about freedom. We are the moral authority of our nation. Our responsibility is to be the other voice and the other authority, because there's a dual authority in the country. There's one authority representing the reactionary and evil and criminal policies of this administration. And then there's the authority of people who love and yearn for justice and peace and human rights. Our authority is the authority that must prevail in the moral universe that God has created. Because really, the Bible says, blessed are the peacemakers, for we are the sons and daughters of God. And the Bible says that justice must roll down like a mighty stream, not like a trickle. Amen. If that is the mandate that we have a responsibility to go forth from this meeting tonight to ensure that justice is done by organizing in the schools, organizing in the mosque, organizing in the churches, organizing in the community centers, getting out to the metro stops, doing everything that's necessary to educate the people, to bring people who are not with us alone. We cannot win the struggle by ourselves. We must exponentially expand the ranks of those who are fighting for freedom. We cannot do it just with ourselves. So what I am saying to you in my 2.5 minutes left, that we have the responsibility to speak out forcefully against racism. People don't want to talk about racism anymore. But let me tell you something. We're not whining about it. Why did 60% of the white electorate vote for Bush and 89% of the black electorate vote for Kerry? It's not genetics. It's experiential. And I want to say to my white brothers and sisters, you have a responsibility tonight to go forth and talk to some of your racist white brothers and sisters who are so blinded by their racism and their ultra-nationalism that they cannot see the forest for the trees. So as I conclude, go and write your letter. Go and send your postcard. Go and march. If you're sitting on the sideline, you're part of the problem and you're not part of the solution. You're not doing God's work. In my 30 seconds left, I love y'all. Black Voices for Peace loves you. And I did it in 5 minutes.
And that was Damu Smith of Black Voices for Peace speaking at the Plymouth Congregational Church in Washington, D.C. on Friday night. As we wrap up tonight with John Hess, longtime journalist and radio commentator, John Hess has died at the age of 87. For 24 years, he worked at the New York Times. In 1968, covered the Paris Peace Talks, a major expose on nursing home corruption, also known for his writings as a food critic. In 1977, he co-wrote a book with his wife, Karen Hess, entitled The Taste of America. In it, they wrote, quote, "How shall we tell our fellow Americans that our palates have been ravaged, that our food is awful, and that our most respected authorities on cookery are posers?" Last year, Seven Stories published John Hess's autobiography called My Times, A Memoir of Dissent. In it, he criticized his former employer, the New York Times. He wrote, quote, "Muckraking tended to make the Times brass nervous. Truly investigating, questioning, skeptical reporting was practically un-Timesian," he wrote. After retiring from the Times, John Hess became a popular and regular commentator on the WBAI Evening News, WBAI New York, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. John continued writing and recording commentaries up until his death. We go now to a commentary John Hess recorded for WBAI on June 4th of last year upon the resignation of the Director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet.
"It was embarrassing to watch our Director of Central Intelligence sniveling that he had to go home early to care for his darling wife and kiddies, and to see his boss let him go and say what a good boy he'd been. Just think of it. The man has been in charge of the gathering and analysis of information about the American world empire and of the espionage, eavesdropping, bribery, and all the dirty tricks. Tuning in, you might find it hard to believe that our nation got along without a CIA from the time it was born to beyond World War II. We even had a Secretary of State who said gentlemen did not read each other's mail. Then the Cold War set in. A task force reported to President Eisenhower, quote, hitherto acceptable norms of human conduct do not apply. If the U.S. is to survive, long-standing American concepts of fair play must be reconsidered. It may become necessary that the American people be made acquainted with, understand, and support this fundamentally repugnant philosophy," unquote. The American public were never made fully acquainted with this fundamentally repugnant philosophy. Most were shocked when bits of it leaked out. When President Ford blurted that our dirty tricks included attempts to assassinate foreign leaders, it was seriously proposed that we disband the CIA. Its excuse disappeared with the collapse of the Soviet Union. But the monster lives on, as repugnant as ever. Scandals every day. Yet our media have been so conditioned to it that there's been no suggestion that it be disbanded or even cut back, except in alternate media like ours, which remain loyal to long-standing American concepts of fair play."
John Hess, WBAI Evening News commentator, died this weekend. Also former New York Times writer. He died at the age of 87. That does it for today's program. Special thanks to Andrea Sears, Bernard White, Errol Maitland. Our producers are Mike Berkshroof, Abdul Kadus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are engineers. You can see John Hess's commentaries at WBAI.org. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks to Joe Friendly. Thanks for joining us.